Support for NPR comes from Prudential Retirement, a Prudential financial business with retirement plan solutions for over 7,000 organizations and 3 million participants. Prudential Retirement.
News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Lou Hopkins in celebration of Susan Hopkins on her 60th birthday.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts in performance and presentation.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with Walter Mosley. He's the author of 21 critically acclaimed books, both fiction and nonfiction, but he is probably best known for a popular mystery series featuring a character named E.Z. Rawlins. The first book in that series was Devil in a Blue Dress. That was published in 1990, and he has now just published the 10th book in this series. The latest installment is entitled Cinnamon Kiss, and it is out now in bookstores if you would like to take a look at it, and of course, as are all the other books in this series. As a prequel to the series, he published a book called Gone Fishin' in 1997. He has written two other series, in a sense, featuring other characters that still fit in that kind of crime genre. He has written three works of literary fiction, two works of science fiction, two works of nonfiction. He's also published short pieces in a number of publications, among them The New Yorker, Esquire, GQ, The LA Times Magazine, and Savoy. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome, certainly, if you'd like to talk with our guest, Walter Mosley. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So any point here, if you have questions, you want to call in, be a part of the conversation, that's welcome. The only thing we ask is people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving along. But anyone is welcome to call. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Mosley, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
I want to start by talking a little bit about the distinction between literary fiction and popular fiction. And I know that there are some people for whom this is important, and then there are others, and I think probably a lot of writers would say, this doesn't really mean anything.
The only thing I can say is that Shakespeare was popular fiction. Hmm. So, I mean, and so was the Iliad and the Odyssey. And the thing is that popular fiction and literary fiction, that there can't be any room between them. There can be a failure at either one, but that's just failure.
Yeah, that's I don't know who I was talking with somebody about this very subject, and I think the writer just said, well, you know, what I'm trying to do is tell a good story.
Yeah,
and that's what's really important. Do you,
and in doing that, you might rise to a level of literature, and you might not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you like to think of yourself as being someone who writes literary at that level, literary fiction, or do you even not like to think about that as applies to your own work?
Well, you know, like the writer you talked to before, I try to write as good a book as I can on the various levels that one does that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a question of the story, there's a question of language, there's a question of musicality, all those things. I mean, because even when you talk about literary fiction, not everybody agrees on what that means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, so the idea of a good story, for instance, might not enter into somebody's notion of literary fiction, or even the idea of the use of language might not. It might simply be the ideas, you know. But I think all of those things are, you know, really important. I try to do my best at all of it.
Yeah. The character E.Z. Rawlins, when he is first introduced in this series, the book, the Devil in a Blue Dress, is set in 1948, and it is not that long after the end of the war. He has served in World War II in Europe. He's now a relatively young man. He's working in a defense plant, and in the course of the story, or early on in the story, ends up losing his job because he has a dispute with a supervisor, who is white, and ends up taking his first detective job because he needs the money, and he's really afraid that he's going to lose his house, which is very important to him. He's got to make a mortgage payment. So that's sort of the thing that drives that first story. And then now, over the course of these many novels, you get a chance to develop the character and to see him change and to grow and to become more self-assured and to become a family man and change a lot. And so we're looking there in the book time at a period of something like 18 years.
Yep.
Perhaps you can talk a little bit about this character and how you see him change. And at this point now in Cinnamon Kiss, where in book time it's 1966, how over time this character has changed?
Well, you know, Easy's changed in a lot of ways. One way, he's just gotten older. He's 46 years old now. He's only 28 in Devil in a Blue Dress. And, of course, in Gone Fishing, he's only 19. He's changed as a man growing older. While he's been changing, the world around him has changed. So, you know, in 1948, there's like a deep chasm between white and black in America. And Easy lives in a black world, and his relationship with white people is almost always the same because of, you know, America and America's history. By 1966, especially after the Watts riots, all of that is mixed up. His relation to other black people, his relation to white people, is changed greatly. But one of the more interesting things about Easy, though, are ways in which he doesn't change or can't change. He's still a child of the 1920s in the Deep South in many ways. And so his understanding of the world can't be freed up enough for him to do certain kinds of things. So, you know, for instance, Jackson Blue's girlfriend, Jewel, knows much more about real estate than Easy and is much better at it because she's not limited by the history of who she has to be in the world.
Yeah.
And so some of the ways what's interesting about Easy is how he's changed. And in other ways, it's how the world has changed, but he has been unable to make those transitions.
So it raises an interesting idea, and that is, in one sense, an author creates a character, and you would say, well, you can, because you created that character, you can do anything you like with him or her. And though the fact of the matter is that once you've created the character and provided them with a world to live in and with certain sorts of experiences, then that places limits on what you can do with that character.
Absolutely.
You can't do anything you want.
No, you can't. I mean, really, it's absolutely true. There are things that you can't make out of him, and this is not going to happen. And if you did it, wouldn't sound true. The novel wouldn't sound like it's making sense, especially if you know the whole history of it. But even in a singular book, it wouldn't make sense. You'd have to start changing his history in some kind of way to make him a completely different person.
Hmm. What led to the creation of these other characters that inhabit the same world, in a sense? Fearless Jones, Paris Minton, Socrates Fortlaw.
Well, you know, Socrates is very different, I think. You know, I mean, certainly it's not really a crime series in any way. It's more a kind of fictional philosophy series. I guess the only thing I could really say about it, because, you know, I mean, Socrates really is a philosopher, and that's how I'm developing him. But the thing is that the thing that they all have in common, of course, is that they're black male heroes. In a literary landscape where there are almost no black male heroes. I mean, there are a lot of black male protagonists and antagonists, but there are not a lot of black male heroes. I mean, you know, those kind of heroic characters, you know, David Copperfield, you know, or James Bond, or, you know, whatever kind of one you want to talk about, the characters that you identify with and who give you hope for, you know, a future possibility in the world. And the only thing that I do is write about black male heroes. So you have everybody, Paris and Fearless and Easy, even Mouse, Socrates Fortlow. But through all my books, I'm talking about that because it's so, I think, well, you know, there's such a vacuum there.
When you set out to write the first novel, this in the late 1980s, the novel that became Devil in a Blue Dress, did you right away, did you have this impulse to write in this genre?
Oh, no. The first book, by the way, is Gone Fishing. That's the first book I wrote. Nobody wanted to publish it. I was writing a book about that migration, a series of books, not unlike, I was like thinking about Zola, you know, writing a series about a group of people who something happens to. I'm writing about this group of people who move from the Deep South into California. And what does that mean from Texas and Louisiana? And, you know, I wrote the first book and nobody wanted to publish it. And the notion was that, well, you know, white people didn't read about black people, black women didn't like black men, and black men didn't read, so who's going to read your book? You know, it didn't bother me all that much. And I started writing another book, and that was Devil in a Blue Dress. I didn't realize until I was halfway through the book that it was going to be a mystery. And, you know, then I went, wow, it's a mystery. And people seem to like that very much.
So that in a way, though, the thing that is all in all of these books, the experience of being black in America and being a black man, the thing that you just can't get away from, because obviously the characters can't get away from that.
Mm-hmm.
That's I'm wondering in how direct a way did that start out being something that you said, no matter what else I'm doing here, this is going to be something that I know I want to be writing about in a very
well. The answer to that question is I didn't realize I was doing it until I wrote Black Betty.
Huh.
When I finished writing Black Betty, I looked at it and I was on tour. Somebody says, "So what is the subject of all your novels?" Somebody asked that, you know, kind of insightful question, and I went, "Oh, black male heroes." And I said it, not completely believing it even. And the next day, I went, you know, that was true. It really is. That really is what I'm doing here. So.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is novelist Walter Mosley. He has written a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction. And as I said at the beginning, probably people will know him best for the series of crime novels that revolve around this character named E.Z. Rawlins. And the first one of those books was Devil in a Blue Dress. It was published in 1990, was made into a movie starring Denzel Washington, and he has now published the 10th book in this series. The title is Cinnamon Kiss. It's published by Little Brown. It is out now, and of course all the other books are in print. You might be interested in reading those. You might be interested in sampling some of his science fiction. He's written a number of different kinds of things. Questions here are welcome, too, and we have a couple of people who'd like to talk with the guest. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Both callers are in Urbana. We'll start with line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Mosley on how he developed the voice. I believe that's the correct term. Every one of us writes in a particular voice. And was it something that developed for him, shall we say, in a natural way, or is this something that he has been identifying for his particular character?
So that question is like the voice for the E.Z. Rawlins novels, because I think probably there are different voices for different books I write.
Mm.
I mean, and they're, you know, because I mean, like, for instance, I'll write the Fearless Jones series, and that's from the point of view of a guy named Paris Minton. You know, Paris is a very different guy than E.Z. Rawlins. He's small, and he's kind of cowardly, and he's a bookworm. And he doesn't have a lot of... it's not that he doesn't care about people around him, it's just that he doesn't care enough to do anything to help them. He's usually only helping himself. So that's a very different kind of character than E.Z. Rawlins. But the thing is I don't really think about that when I'm writing. I just start writing. And the thing is that when you're writing a book, the most important thing is narrative voice. And the most important thing in narrative voice is the consistency of that voice. And so once you start writing, you follow how that character is, you know, thinking, talking, responding, reacting. And when you're rewriting, you make sure that it always is the same character doing that. If you all of a sudden make this character talk in a very different way or think in a very different way, it stands out. You have to get rid of it or change it into something else.
Well, thank you very much. That was very helpful.
All right. Thanks for the call. I read that one of the things that you do when you're working is after you have written a section, you actually read it out loud into a tape recorder and play it back and listen to it because you want to hear what it sounds like when it's read out.
Actually, not a section, the whole book. What I do is I've written the whole book, and then I may go through 10 or 12 drafts of the book. And at that point, I know intellectually that I'm not really seeing the words anymore. After you read something enough times, you stop reading the words. You know what they are already. So you're only looking really for cues. And so you may be making really big mistakes. The other thing is, of course, to understand that voice and also to understand how the novel reads. Reading it out loud is an incredible help.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Urbana, also line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Your guest once did an audio essay on NPR called Lessons on Losing Friends.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
I was stunned when I heard that. It seemed to me such deep thoughts in that, and I went back and listened to it again on the NPR site. And I wondered if you have writings where you write kind of more directly about your thoughts like you expressed in that audio essay, or would recommend readings that kind of along that line.
Well, I haven't really. That was one experience that I had, and you know, NPR had said to me, "Well, if you have anything like that, write it up, send it to us. We'll see if you want it." You know, I have other things I've done for them, but they're very different.
Right.
And I haven't really. I said it's an unusual piece. It's more like a piece that I would have in a letter, or you know, every year I send out kind of a Christmas notice to everyone, and I may come up with something like that. But as a rule, feelings like that only appear in places in my fiction, responses to the characters. But thank you very much. I'm glad that you like it. It's fun. You know, it's nice to hear a response about those things.
Yeah. Do you ever get in a mood where you want to read or hear thoughts like that? And if so, where do you go?
I didn't answer that question, that part of the question, because I don't really have an answer for that. It's like, you know, it's kind of like falling in love. You know, you travel around the world, and every once in a while you come across something like that, and you go, oh, wow.
Well, I kind of thought that might be your answer, because it had a very special feeling to it. If you ever get in the mood to do some more of those, I hope you will, because, well, like I said, I thought it was great.
Thank you very much. Right, thank you. Right,
thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. If you'd like to talk with our guest, Walter Mosley, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. As I have read many of the comments that you made when people have asked you about writing, you have said things along the line that you feel that you write just because you're compelled to do it. I think one quote was, you said, "The reason I'm a writer is because I'm a writer." That is what you are. That is what you do. But you came to it seemingly in a kind of an indirect way. You went to college and studied political science, and you worked for a while in computer programming. When you started writing, I'm interested in what was going on at the time that you actually started writing, and whether there was anything in particular that got you started or that you were thinking about trying to do at that point.
Probably. Probably that's true. I was going through a period of my life where I was a computer programmer, and not for a while. I've been for a long time. Off and on for 15 years I'd been a programmer. And I enjoyed it okay each day. I didn't want to get to my end of my life and look at the end of it and see me having been a programmer all those years, however. And I wanted to do something else. I wanted to be an artist. It's not that I thought I was good in anything. I wanted to do something creative because that's what I enjoyed the most in life and in the world. And I had tried many things. I tried drawing. I tried pottery. I tried to learn a musical instrument. You know, and none of it really worked. And one day I was sitting there at work. It was a Saturday, and I just wrote that sentence, which you may have also come across: "On hot, sticky days in southern Louisiana, the fire ants swarmed." Now, I knew it sounded good enough to be the beginning of a novel, because I'd read a lot of novels, and so I liked that. And it sounded creative because I'd never been to Louisiana, and I'd never seen a fire ant. But I still had a feeling of them in the sentence. And so I said, well, let me try this now. And I just started writing.
One of the things that I have read, and you can tell me whether it's true or not, is that when you were started to work on Devil in a Blue Dress, that your idea was to write a novel that could be the basis for a screenplay. And I don't know if that's
true. I was thinking
that
because I had read about Graham Greene. I've almost forgotten that, but Graham Greene saying when they asked him to write The Third Man, he decided he would write the novel first to see, you know, to see what it would be like, and then he went to write the screenplay. And I don't know if that was true or not, but I read it, and I think he wrote it in the introduction to the the third man. And so I thought, wow, that's great. That's fantastic. I'm gonna do like something like that. So kind of fooling myself into being able to write a novel.
Well, I wonder if that, if somehow in your mind that it shaped the way that you wrote the novel, that whether you thought that it was in any way cinematic or there was something about the way that you approached images or anything in the way that you wrote it.
Not really. Mm-hmm. You know, because I had no idea what writing screenplay was. And mm-hmm. I didn't go out and look into it or anything. I didn't research it. I think that probably there's certain elements of my writing which is influenced by a cinematic aesthetic. Because, you know, I'm of a generation that has, you know, spent every day, every part of every day with some kind of, you know, television or movie input. But I don't think that the books are particularly easily transferable into film or that I give that a lot of consideration. Hmm.
What did you think about the movie version of A Devil in
the Dress? Oh, I loved it. That was great.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful film. And all the acting, all the directing, the cinematography, everything about it was wonderful.
You said that when you were writing Devil in a Blue Dress, it was you were some way into the book before you realized it was a mystery.
Yeah.
And, of course, now you're really well known, as even though you've worked in different genres and you've written some science fiction. I think people think of you as being a mystery writer, and then there inevitably will be comparisons to other mystery writers, for example. And it may just have something to do with the fact that the books are set in Los Angeles, but it seems that often you're compared to Raymond Chandler, for example.
Yeah.
Do you see anything in that, or are there other mystery writers that you particularly identify with or whose work appeals to you?
Yeah, my relationship to Chandler is kind of, it's like a negative release, you know? You have Chandler writing about one Los Angeles and one kind of guy, and I'm writing about the other L.A. and the other kind of guy. So I'm like, you know, it's good to compare me to Chandler because we hardly at all touch the same ground. And then when we do, it's kind of an interesting spark. You know, this is the part of Los Angeles that what was Chandler's character's name? I forgot it.
Sam Spade.
Hi, huh?
Sam Spade.
No, that's
that's Dashiell Hammett.
Hammett. Doesn't matter. it's the part of town where he wouldn't go. You know, but I'm not sure that there's anything. There's much. You know. Yeah, you know, Chandler's a very flowery writer. It's interesting. You know, I like Ross McDonald a lot more than I like Chandler, because you know McDonald, yeah, there's an economy to his language that's just extraordinary, and there's an attention to his, especially his similes, which are just so perfect. One of his books, I don't remember which one. There's a guy has knocked out Lou Archer and it hasn't tied up and. Watcher looks at him, and he's afraid of him because he looks so calm. And he says, "He was calm, like an adobe wall in moonlight." And when I read that sentence, oh my God, it's so beautiful, mm-hmm. It's so perfect, and it's so California. It was like it was everything. The whole book was in that one little simile. I was 17 years old. I remember reading it and being so moved by it.
Yeah. It strikes me that this sort of style of writing, the hard-boiled detective novel, it's something that, well, at least it's been parodied an awful lot, and it strikes me as it's something that's easy to do badly and hard to do well.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether, in fact, you know, there are times when you, and that must be true of everybody, there are times when you write something and initially you think that's really great, and you go back and look at it and you think, what did I think was great about that? And so you mm-hmm. tear
yeah,
it
absolutely.
Up. And
hopefully,
it
hopefully
up.
Before I publish the book, I have that idea. But sometimes not. Sometimes later on I go, oh my God, this is in print. I'll just turn the page quickly, ignore it. I'm not a hard-boiled writer. Neither was Chandler. I don't think McDonald was either. Hammett's a hard-boiled writer. Hmm. The really, you know, when he says things like, I hit him with the door repeatedly. That's a hard-boiled line. It's funny. It's mean. It's violent. You know, that's hard-boiled. I'm not a hard-boiled writer. I write crime stories. They're noir to a certain degree. They have other elements to them. My stories are very political, for instance. Usually. And But we all kind of live in the same neighborhood. You know, that's all. We don't live in the same house.
Yeah. Let's talk with somebody else here nearby in a community of Belgium. Line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Howdy.
Yes, how are you?
Good.
Good. Yes, I read quite a while ago, I read your Devil in the Blue Dress.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoyed it. I haven't read anything else by you, unfortunately. But, okay, you were talking about Ross McDonald, and I wonder if you could compare your writing to John D. McDonald.
You know, I haven't read much of John D. McDonald, and it was so long ago that I have nothing left in my head. I mean, I remember liking it when I read it, but I can't talk about him, much less compare him to somebody else.
You know, the Travis McGee character.
Yeah, I know. And even though we have something in common, because I use colors in my my titles for
right, and he does too. Yeah, he does too. Yeah,
but no, I can't make that comparison. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And again, other questions are welcome. If you'd like to talk with our guest for this part of Focus 580, Walter Mosley, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Walter Mosley is the author of 21 critically acclaimed books, the popular mystery series featuring E.Z. Rollins, the series that began with Devil in a Blue Dress in 1990. The others in the series are A Red Death, White Butterfly, Black Betty, A Little Yellow Dog, Bad Boy, Burley Brown, and Six Easy Pieces, and then the prequel to that series, Gone Fishin'. He's also written the Fearless Jones novels, and he has written two works of science fiction and two works of nonfiction. And you can find all of his books in the library or the bookstore. He's just published the 10th novel in the E.Z. Rollins series, and the title of the book is Cinnamon Kiss, and it's published by Little Brown. He's out now in the bookstores. Questions? Welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that politics certainly feature in your books. The novel that came before Cinnamon Kiss, Little Scarlet, happens just days after the Watts riots,
mm-hmm.
and then Cinnamon Kiss is not all that long after that. It's the next year, and certainly that's a focus in a way. Well, it's certainly a focus of Little Scarlet, and in a sense, it is referenced in Cinnamon Kiss. You grew up in Los Angeles when the riots took place. You were 12.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah,
13, maybe. Yeah, 12, so 12, 13. And you have written about that being an important event in American history, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
In what sort of impression did that make on you? Obviously, it was a lasting impression.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's a very hard question to answer partially because I wouldn't want anyone to think that any impression it made on me was what I think it made on the world, because I think those are different things. Mm-hmm. I happened on the worst night of the riots to be out in Watts with an interracial group of people in a car. It was kind of an odd experience. I was an actor at that time. We were in a performance that didn't come off, but we went to do it, and we were driving through it, and I saw a lot of things happening. And they had an impact on me, but not so great. The other impact, though, was my father, who was really upset and got very drunk. We lived on the other side of town at that time. And I saw he was upset, and I asked him why. And he said, well, you know, it's these riots. And I said, are you afraid? He goes, no, I'm not afraid. He said, I want to go out there. I know why these people are mad. I want to go out there. I want to riot. I want to fight. I want to throw Molotov cocktails. And I said, well, are you going to? And he goes, no, I'm not, because I know it's wrong. It's wrong for me to do it, but I don't think it's wrong that the people are doing it. There was that kind of ambivalence he had, and that had an incredible impact on me, the anger and the violence in my father that he never showed, but that the riots brought out in him, in his heart.
Yeah. I'm inclined to think that there might be at least a little bit of your father in E.Z. Rollins.
Well, you know, there is some, but I think it comes more from the fact that my father was my hero, and so me talking about black male heroes comes from my relationship with my father. It comes more from that than it does from who he was as a man. I don't think, you know, E.Z. and my father they would have some relationship to each other, but he's a different character. Hmm. He thinks in different ways, and he acts in much different ways.
Let's talk with some other people who would like to talk with you. Someone here in Muhammad, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to thank Mr. Mosley for like his novels because they've given me a lot of pleasure. I really appreciate them a great deal.
Thanks.
And I think they have a lot of erudition behind them, which is one thing I appreciate, among other stylistic things. And I think you deserve a place in the pantheon of the people we've been speaking of and you've been speaking of in the show. I guess one other thing I was maybe a little curious about, do you see yourself, I sort of see a tendency to be realistic, in the sort of real, like a realistic painter, to sort of try to portray details of a life, especially in the past, it appeals to me more, but even in the present. Do you still see that as part of one of your tendencies in your writing?
I think it's a large aspect of my writing. However, when you look at a naturalist writer like somebody like Zola, for instance, it's completely there in the real world, and it's unremitting. He never leaves it. And in my books, you do, like for instance, Easy's Dreams, are these wild things that happen in in Cinnamon Kiss. He's seen this really grotesque. This corpse was in this grotesque position. Mm. And later on, he's having a dream, and the corpse comes alive and puts himself back together, partially back together in a way, and has a conversation with Easy. And while he's having a conversation, a phone is ringing, and they're talking about the phone ringing. And it's still in the real world, but there's a kind of a fabulous feeling to it. And I do that a lot in my works. And of course, when I'm writing science fiction or other stuff, you really can't call it realist because these crazy things happen in it. But all of that being said, I think that one of my jobs as a fiction writer, and especially as an African-American fiction writer, is to talk about the lives and the languages of people that have been left out of fiction. And in that, when I'm doing that, I strive to be very realistic so that the people who have lived these lives can see themselves in it, and the people who know nothing about those lives can understand themselves in the reflection, in this dark mirror.
What you're just mentioning is probably the most appealing aspect of your novels for me, I think.
Well, thanks.
Sort of sociological insights and such.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is someone listening in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning. Hey, first, kind of piggybacking on that last caller, I just want to say I've read several really outspoken comments you've made about the really disturbing political situation in the world, and I just want to thank you for being a person of conscience in addition to being such a good writer.
I appreciate that.
And secondly, I don't know, I tuned in a little late. Have you talked about 47?
No, not at all. We haven't mentioned 47.
Well, I just read that a couple months ago, and I just hope that book doesn't get lost because it's such a really compelling blend of historical fiction and science fiction, and some of the passages in there about slave life are just so memorable. So I hope you might mention that book.
Yeah, well, the reason I wrote 47 was that it came to me that it's very hard to get black people, young or old, to read about slavery or to think about it because it's so sad. If you identify with the characters in slavery, you're going to identify with people who suffer their entire lives and then die. So what I did was I wanted to create a character who you knew from the first page was not going to, they might suffer, but they're not going to die, and they're going to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know that from the beginning, if you can identify with the main character in that way, then you might have the heart to finish the book. Because you're not dreading coming to the end, when he's crucified or executed or thrown back into slavery and dying there. So I wanted a book that both children and their parents could read. So I would say that 47 is a young adult novel in the same way that Huckleberry Finn is a young adult novel.
Well, I hope teachers find that one and read some of that out loud in a classroom and inspire some kids to pick it up.
Yeah, well, I hope so. There's been some good glimmers on it. I guess it'll go into paperback soon, and the schools buy it once it's in paperback. So hopefully that will be the case. That's what I wanted to do.
Well, thank you so much. Keep at it.
Very good. Well, thanks again for the call. Others are welcome. I'd like to talk with our guest, Walter Mosley, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about another prominent character that runs through this Easy Rollins series, and that's his friend Raymond Alexander, the man whose nickname is Mouse. In the book, In Cinnamon Kiss, someone is talking to Easy, and she says, of Easy, she says, you're the most dangerous man in any room you're in. Maybe because in detective novels, people who bump into the detective sometimes end up dead. But he, if you're talking about the guy who's the most dangerous man in any room he's in, I would think that'd be much more true of Mouse than that would be of
Well, Mouse
Easy.
Is more of a threat than Easy. Mouse is a physical threat. he will kill you.
Yes.
You know. But he's probably not going to look at you. The thing is that you could be in a room with Mouse, and he will leave. If you leave him alone, he'll leave you alone. That's the rule of thumb. But Easy, even if he's helping you, if you come to Easy and you have a problem and he saves your life, you would have been better off dead. That's what Edame meant. Easy is a real existentialist hero, and you have to deal with the tragedy of the human condition if you're going to deal with Easy. And so even Mouse. And Little Yellow Dog, trying to stay, trying to keep up with Easy, got shot so bad he almost died.
Yeah.
Even Mouse. So Easy is really, he is a danger. Now, Mouse, he's another character. Easy is the hero of the novel because he tells the story. But Mouse is the hero of Easy's world. And why is he a hero? He's a hero, he's a sociopath, he's a murderer, he's a criminal, he's a philanderer, if such a word would fit him. But the truth is that he's the only black man around who's not afraid of anything. As most black men know, you have to spend your life, if you're going to survive, you have to spend your life being worried about things. Who's that behind me? Who's that in front of me? Why is that door unlocked? Oh, there are the police. What is my wife doing? What is my best friend doing? All you have to worry all the time. Mouse doesn't worry about anything, ever. He is a man who's not afraid. And that makes him a great man, not only for black people, by the by. And so he becomes, he gains this kind of heroic status because he's like everybody's hope.
I think he's an interesting character because his functions in the story seem to be multiple, and on one level, sort of on a superficial level, a lot of mystery and crime fiction, the detective's got to have backup. So Mouse is as Easy's backup, but also he's in such an interesting character for the reasons that you cite, because he's a character of great dark depths, and he functions as a foil, as an offset, as a contrast in a lot of ways to Easy. So he's a very important character, and for more reasons just then, detectives got to have somebody that they can lean on who's going to be there when they need extreme force to be applied.
Yeah, it's true. Though it often turns out that Easy ends up having to take care of himself. I mean, it's a funny situation that Mouse helps him out sometimes, it's true. But more times than not, he doesn't. In the final moment, Easy has to rely on himself, you know. And so the relationship is a funny one. Mouse and the people who are threatened by him depend much more on Easy than Easy depends on Mouse.
Let's talk again with another caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to... thank you for all the works you've written. I've enjoyed reading your various genres. I did enjoy 47, and it brought to mind a different writer. I don't know if you're familiar with him, also a black writer, Julius Lester.
I only know Julius by name.
Oh, well, okay, then. I was going to ask you if because it's a work for, as you say, teenagers, and I read it with my son. And I've read some of his works for teenagers. Okay. I wondered if you could also talk a little about your background and how you see that. I mean, you did mention your father and talked a little about him, but if you could talk a little more about your family background and how you see that influencing your writing and your creations of families in whether Easy Rollins or the other works.
No, okay. You know, it's a very hard question for me to answer, because when I think about my, you know, my family, and my father's black from Louisiana, was an orphan from the age of 8. My mother's Jewish from New York, an only child, daughter of a doctor. I'm an only child, born and raised in California. How all of that influences me, I don't really know. You know, my father was a very much believed very strongly in education himself, though it's kind of something, it was like an act of will for him, you know, being, you know, raised around a lot of people who didn't necessarily care or didn't see education as paramount. My mother brings a whole culture of education with her, a whole notion of that, well, you know, you can't live without this. And that wasn't only her, it was everybody in her family would think this, everybody in a whole culture thinking this. It's such an easy thing to say, but to identify exactly what that impact was on me, I know that I being an only child and loving and being very, very verbal, I think that writing was the only thing that I could have ended up at. I mean, it's a surprise that I didn't start until my mid-30s. And my parents who, you know, I can just say this. One day, I walked up to my father, I was about 12 or 13, and I said, "Dad, what do you want me to be?" And he said, "I don't know what you mean." I said, "Well, you know, when I grow up, what do you think I should study in school? What do you think I should be when I grow up?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "But what do you want me to be?" And he said, "Walter, I want you to be happy." And I said, "But Dad, but should I be a doctor? Should I be a lawyer?" He said, I don't know. Whatever makes you happy, that's what you be. If you're happy, I'm happy. And so my relationship with him runs a lot like that, that he wasn't going to make it easy for me, and he wasn't going to get in my way. Those are those two things. But, yeah, and I know that's not a really good answer to your question, but it's the best I can give at the moment.
If I could follow up, since you're saying your family, in a sense, is a how is the intersection between whatever Jewish culture you talked about in terms of your mother and black culture in terms of your father, how was that and how is that?
I mean, it's interesting about multiracial identities in America. You know, like all black people are multiracial. Most white people are, but they don't know it. But all black people are, and most of them know it. And so, you know, because that's true, and because I have always known that was true, I didn't feel very different because of it. But I think that, my parents got along very well. It's one of the interesting things about these Rollins novels. A lot of people, a lot of different cultures. Easily, he has really good friends who are Jewish and who are Mexican and who are all kinds of like different things, Asian, and that's the reality of Los Angeles, because in Los Angeles, everybody moved in after the war, and so there wasn't enough time to segregate the workplace. Where people lived was kind of segregated, but the workplace itself couldn't be segregated. Everybody had to work together, and there were only two races: there were white people and others. And Jews were part of the others, the ones who, you know, who had migrated from Europe, or who were the first children, the people who had migrated from Europe. And so there was an incredible kind of sharing of people and cultures. And that's still true in Los Angeles, though the media seems to want to deny it all the time. Everybody's fighting. Everybody's hating each other. Nobody likes each other. But I don't see that. I don't experience it when I'm in Los Angeles either. So that mixture between my parents and also from my upbringing in Los Angeles was very wonderful.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Our guest this morning is Walter Mosley. He's the author of a number of books, fiction and non. He's just recently published the 10th installment in the E.Z. Rollins crime series. The title of the book is Cinnamon Kiss. It's published by Little Brown. We have about 10 minutes left. About 5 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I know your red comments that make it really obvious that to you, you would like the readers to respond to the characters that you create like they were real people. And in fact, I read one story that I liked where this must have happened some time ago, because I think it was in regards to Devil in a Blue Dress, that you had done a book signing or doing a talk or something, and somebody came up to you and said that they were really looking forward to reading the next book in the series because Easy had done something that so upset them that he wanted to try to understand better why. And here, you know, here he was responding to your character like he was a real guy and was really bothered by something he had done and really wanted to understand. How do you go about, or what do you think is important to creating a character in your writing that people will respond to that way, like they're real?
You create a character. This is a kind of a technical answer. You create a character who, in his pedestrian life, people who read can identify with. How he likes to keep his bedroom clean, what he expects from his children, how he's uncertain in very kind of everyday kind of situations, in a cafe, on the job, etc. And then you transpose that character into a very kind of dynamic, dramatic situation in which this character, who the person who has identified with, now sees this person dealing with stuff that the reader may think about but tries to avoid, or it doesn't end up in those situations. And so then you have the reader kind of taken up in the wake of this character who they identify with and either respect or have deep feeling for, depending on, you know. I mean, you might not respect Miles, but you're going to have deep feeling for him. So then later on, when that character, after you've done that, people begin to identify with that character. It says, it's like I know him because, you know, he's like me. I did that, or my father did that, or my cousin did that. And so they become part of their lives. And in becoming part of their lives, they begin to have expectations and concerns about that character. I think that's like, you know, it's kind of like a, you know, like fiction writing 101, but though there is no fiction writing 101. Nobody ever teaches it.
Let's talk with someone in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I was reminded of a when Mr. Mosley was asked about how different aspects of his life influenced his writing, etc. I was reminded of hearing the poet W.H. Auden about 40 years ago, and someone in the audience said, "Mr. Auden, could you tell us, please, how has being a Roman Catholic affected your writing?" And he said, "First of all, I'm Episcopalian. Secondly, I just live my life, and it'll be somebody's dissertation to figure out the effect of different components on my life."
Mm.
I do enjoy Mr. Mosley's writing, and thank you for listening.
All right, great. Thanks. And you want to comment on anything the caller had to say?
I like what he had to say. I wish I had seen W.H. Auden.
Well, let's talk with somebody else here. We'll go to Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Mr. Mosley, I was just jolted when you gave a description of all the things black people must be concerned about in their life. Now, I really don't. I'm a white person. I don't have any black friends. But I keep hearing about the differences, and that they feel that exist in the United States. And this is the first time I ever heard anyone enumerate them. And I haven't even had time to react to them.
Well, you know, I have a book coming out. I have a million books coming out, but I have a book coming out in January called Life Out of Context. The subtitle of the book, it's a nonfiction, a political monograph, Life Out of Context, and then there's a subtitle called with a proposal for a nonviolent takeover of the House of Representatives. it's a very political book, and it begins to speak about how I see America working. And of course, you know, there's no, like, you know, deep differences. I mean, there are deep differences, but there's not only differences between black and white Americans. But there are things that are so amazing. Like, for instance, hopefully I can say this before the time is up. if you have a white person watching Rodney King getting beaten, and you have a black person watching Rodney King getting beaten, the white person will think, I'm outraged by this, mostly, almost everyone. I'm outraged by this. This is terrible. This is awful. This shouldn't happen. The black person is also mad, and the white person will think automatically, well, that black person feels like I feel. He's outraged at this. But there's a big difference. The black person watching it knows that that has happened to his great-great-grandfather, his great-grandfather, his grandfather, his father. It's happened to him, and it's going to happen to his children. Rodney King getting beaten is both a tragedy and a threat to the black person. And to the white person, it's a crime. They both are upset about it, and in an immediate way, it's the same thing. But the depth of feeling and the kind of feeling is very, very different. And it's really important to understand that and to know that, because one has to know who they're dealing with in the world. And it's easy to assume that things are the same when indeed they aren't.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We are indeed just about at the point where we have to stop. How much further do you see your stories about Easy Rawlins going?
I'd like him to get about 80.
So you think it's possible to bring him to the – will he see to the year 2000?
He'll see the year 2000.
What else now is coming soon? You have managed to produce an amazing amount of work. You must work all the time.
Every day. I mean, not all the time, but every day.
So you do write every day?
Every day, yeah. The books that are coming out, I'll say really quickly, in November I have I've kind of did a deconstruction of Fantastic Four number one, and Marvel's publishing that in November. In January, I have a science fiction book called The Wave and the political monograph called Life Out of Context. In May, I have a parable called Fortunate Son, and 6 months after that, the new Fearless Jones novel. And then finally, I guess I just made the deal today, I have a book called Killing Johnny Fry, which, for lack of a better term, is a sex novel.
This you expect this to be very controversial? It's an erotic, to say the least. It's an erotic novel.
To say the least, erotic. Erotic means it leaves something to your imagination. This book, at least in 25% of it, leaves nothing to your imagination. I don't know. I hope that people get upset about it. I don't know. Maybe not.
Well, there already is a lot in print. If you haven't read any Walter Mosley, go to the bookstore, go to the library, and then you have some to look forward to. He's just published the 10th in this very popular mystery series involving Easy Rawlins. That book is Cinnamon Kiss, published by Little Brown. Has written science fiction, and also you might want to look at the book. A couple of the callers have mentioned it's a book for young adult readers.
Yeah.
47, the first book for that group of readers. But I'm sure that adults can get a lot out of the book as well.
I think so.
Mr. Mosley, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Our guest, Walter Mosley. Support here for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information available on the web at infantparent.com. Support for the broadcast today also comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world, your suggestions and requests always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. We will break. When we continue, we'll be talking about the Supreme Court and its role in U.S. government and society with Gerald Rosenberg. He's a political scientist at the University of Chicago. First, though, we'll break for news and update on the markets. Please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Deferred pricing contracts available this fall. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandagrienergy.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets at the Chicago Board of Trade. Well, another day in corn futures at the board were weak earlier.